Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. An effort by City Council to put Chicago Public Schools CEO and board members on the hot seat fizzles. The Chatham community on the city's south side has been grappling with a flooding problem for years. A look at efforts to fix it. And Northeastern Illinois' new president on the challenges of leading a public university and her vision for its future. And now to some of today's top stories. Soaring pensions, spiraling personnel costs, and a massive amount of debt are all contributing to the dire financial condition for the city of Chicago, according to a new budget watchdog report. The report from the Civic Federation says Mayor Brandon Johnson should only consider raising property taxes as a last resort to bridge a projected $982 million budget shortfall for 2025. Instead, the group, led by a former city inspector general, urges eliminating vacant positions, increasing the city's garbage fee to charged residents, and maybe skip the additional pension fund payment slated for this year. Mayor Johnson is slated to lay out his budget plan later this month. Families and teachers impacted by the planned closure of seven CPS charter schools are criticizing the plan to close and demanding answers.
What we see here today is due to his model and misdealings. This was bound to happen. Juan Ranjel's charter school model, through Acero, prioritized profits, real estate, and political connections over student needs, particularly in Latino communities. We were his targets.
Last week, the board of directors for Acero Charter Schools voted to close seven campuses at the end of this school year, impacting more than 2,000 students. The Chicago Teachers Union, which represents Acero teachers, says it's the largest closing of majority Latino schools in the district. In response, CTU is asking Chicago Public Schools to assume operation of the schools and says it plans to push the state legislature to pass a moratorium on school closures that includes privately run charters. Meanwhile, Chicago Public Schools sees an increase in enrollment for the second straight year, this after 12 years of steady enrollment declines. Today, the district released its 20th-day figures, which serve as the official count for the school year, showing more than 325,000 students, an increase of just over 2,000. Despite that increase, the district is still much smaller than the 2013-2014 school year, when enrollment topped 400,000 students. CPS says much of this year's increase is driven by Latino students and kindergarten through fifth graders. And enrollment increased for almost all racial and ethnic groups except for black students. There's more of this story on our website. Up next, what happened at today's city council meeting with public school CEO Pedro Martinez, right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
A push by older people to put Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez and board members on the hot seat fizzled today. As turmoil is still swirling around CPS, some city council members demanded immediate action, while others said today's marathon meeting was a waste of time. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharone joins us now to break down today's long but not very eventful hearing. Heather, who showed up for today's meeting with the City Council's Education Committee?
Pretty much only CEO Pedro Martinez and his leadership team. None of the former CPS board members showed up, and none of the new CPS board members showed up. Alderman Jeanette Taylor, the chair of the Education Committee, said the new board members told her they were not prepared to sort of field these questions from the City Council. Now, this is quite a result after all of the back and forth at last Wednesday's City Council meeting, with Alderman Gilbert Villegas threatening to subpoena these board members, and of course the city's top lawyer saying, hold on a minute there, you don't have that authority. That controversy appears to have ended not with a bang, but a whimper.
So did we learn anything new about the financial crisis that CPS is facing?
We did not. Pedro Martinez made the same pitch he made on our show last week, that the city needs to use money set aside from property tax revenues to fight blight and fund redevelopment instead to keep the school district out of the red. Now, we heard Mayor Brandon Johnson said, well, that would be great, but that's probably not going to be enough money, which is why he has urged the district to take out a short-term loan to sort of bridge the gap to what he says will be the full transformation of the school district. But that's where we have been for pretty much a month, and we didn't get anywhere different today.
So all that said, what's next?
Well, the new CPS board is supposed to meet for the first time later this month. At that meeting, they can take action and terminate Pedro Martinez's contract, which would usher in a whole new era for CPS. But the controversy will remain, as well as questions about how the district is structured financially. There are many schools that are very underutilized with not very many students, costing the district lots of money. Now, we learned a little bit today about that controversy, where Pedro Martinez said it was important for him to have that sort of analysis, but that it's not worth it to the district, to wouldn't save much money, and of course create a massive controversy.
And of course, Manoj, then there's that school board election coming up on November 5th on Election Day.
Oh yeah, that.
Oh, that thing. Heather Sharone, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Up next, what's being done to combat persistent flooding in a Southside community? Climate change isn't just creating stronger hurricanes and melting polar ice caps. It's also increasing urban flooding in places like Chicago. And residents of the Chatham neighborhood on the south side experience more flooding than any other community in the city. An Argonne-led project is working to alleviate the problem alongside neighbors who've experienced the damage of urban flooding firsthand. Joining us now with more are Nidra Fears, executive director of the Greater Chatham Initiative and a Chatham resident, and Catherine O'Connor, Director of Engineering at the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago. Thanks to you both for joining us. Nidra, let's start with you, please. You're a longtime Chatham resident, and you actually have a very personal connection to the devastating flooding that happens there. Tell us more about that, please.
Yes, I'm a daughter of Chatham. Our family house, I recall we had four major flood events, two of which the water triggered electrical fires, and we had smoke damage throughout the house. And so we know what it's like personally to live through that. And then I look at my neighbors who also have had serious flooding events, and then I connect the dots between why people have not updated their kitchens and their baths, because if every 6 or 8 years you have a major flood in your basement, that is where you put your additional funds. So it is a significant problem, and it impacts Black wealth.
How have things progressed over the years? How have they worsened?
They're about the same. I mean, when we look at, so Center for Neighborhood Technology did analysis in 2015. We have been looking at 311 calls to report flood events, and we had a major flood event in July of last year where many people experienced flooding. So we are concerned and we're taking steps because we know as the severe weather events occur more often that we, Chicago, it rains. And unfortunately, when it rains in Chicago, it floods in Chatham.
Catherine, how is urban flooding different from the flooding that most of us think about?
Most of us think about riverine flooding, and that's the river gets to a flood stage and overbank flooding. But a more recent focus is urban flooding. Urban flooding is devastating. Homes are a problem. FEMA is designed or it has been established for mostly for riverine flooding, and now even FEMA is refocusing on urban flooding. They see the devastation, they see the heartbreak, they see the terrible expense to residents. So MWRD and FEMA, federal and local governments, are taking a closer look and more of a focus.
Right. We tend to think of it as the kind of thing that occurs in the wake of Hurricane Milton, for example, that we've been seeing lately. But it can happen when Chatham gets a lot of rain, because, Nidra, everywhere in Chicago, of course, we see rain. But Chatham, the surrounding area, as you've said, they flood more than other parts of the city. Tell me about why, how Chatham is situated for that to happen.
Right. So we've been working with Argonne Lab through their Crocus Project, which is a significant project funded by EPA. And they've been helping to use their scientists and their supercomputers to help model and tell us why the flooding is happening. And so this is a five-year project where in year two of five, but preliminary information indicates that basically the water from Chicago is backing up into our homes. So this is an infrastructure problem that, yes, we have a high water table, and yes, we have a high water table, but that doesn't explain disproportionately why water backs up in our basement.
Catherine, does MWRD have any sense of why Chatham is experiencing this specifically?
Well, July 2nd, 2023, the West Side was hit much harder. The 38th Ward, Cicero, and it flooded directly proportional to the rain. They received 9 inches of rain in roughly 12 hours. So I know Chatham does have some low-lying areas. We are aware of some depressional areas in Chatham. So we are working with the city, Chicago Department of Water Management, on creating more green space and intercepting that flow. As much flow as we keep out of the out of the combined sewer, the less likely it is to back up into the home. So on July 2nd, 2023, I think it's informative to know that a typical Chicago house would have discharged on the order of 400 gallons of water from a dishwasher and showers, et cetera. The rain that fell that day was 8,000 gallons fell on the roof of the typical Chicago house. 8,000 gallons versus 4,000 gallons. We want to intercept the roof load, disconnect the downspouts. Water Reclamation District has published the Green Neighbor Guide, and it walks residents through what you can do to protect your home in a green manner. Create more green space if you have the property to meaningfully collect. And we do subsidize rain barrels also to capture the roof load.
Nidra, Greater Chatham Initiative, as you've mentioned, you all are partnered with Argonne to combat this issue, and they're studying and researching it. Take us back to how it started and how you all were able to get involved in a climate project like this.
We're really thrilled with that partnership with Argonne. We have a long-standing relationship with some Argonne officials, and so they asked us if we would participate, and we really grabbed that opportunity because we really want to drill down and figure out why the flooding is happening. So having become a partner with them, we've learned that, as Catherine says, you know, the fancy word bioinfrastructure, putting in trees, putting in native plants, putting in what people can do individually, putting in overhead sewers and sump pumps, all of that's important. But if the reality is that the sewer system can't handle the overflow of rain and is backing up in our basements, we need to fix the pipes. The bioinfrastructure is really important, and we need to do that because, as we all have lived through this, that we have more 300-year flood events. They happen, it seems, every 2 or 3 weeks. And so we don't want to be North Carolina, where they said we couldn't have thought of it, and so therefore we didn't plan for it, and we didn't do anything to protect those folks. So we see Argonne's project as an opportunity to really drill down and to understand what is happening so it can get fixed. So it's not just happenstance.
Catherine, you know, there's a perception that flooding is inevitable based on, you know, geographic location. And, of course, in the city, we've got more concrete and asphalt that does not soak up the rain the way green space might. How can massive floods be prevented?
I don't have a good answer for that. The massive flood.
Still working on that one.
Well, 12 inches of rain or 9 inches of rain in 12 hours, there's no system that can handle that. So what we need for that is adaptive management, and we need to make sure that things are off of the floor in the basement. That's a major challenge. But we do want to be flood resilient. We have over 250 projects in design or construction. We've taken 19,000 structures out of significant flood risk in just the 10 years that Water Reclamation District has had authorization to work on local projects. We work very closely with Chicago Department of Water Management. After the flood last July, we do have a significant project in the works, approved by our Board of Commissioners for construction on the west side of Chicago, and that will protect hundreds of homes. But those huge 9 inches of rain, that was not forecast. I don't know. We just want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And
of course,
don't know how we do
and
that.
And that folks are as prepared for it as they can be. We have to leave it there. Best of luck to you both. Thanks for joining us, Nedra Fears and Catherine O'Connor. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, one-on-one with the new leader of Northeastern Illinois University. It is a challenging time to be the president of a public university. Aside from the perennial task of finding resources to create a compelling educational environment, protests over the war in Gaza have been roiling campuses across the country. Northeastern Illinois University has certainly seen its fair share in recent years, including a narrowly averted strike and the departure of the former university president following a vote of no confidence by faculty. Now, a new leader is officially taking the reins of leadership at NEIU, although we should note she has been serving as interim president since July of 2023, but I do believe she was inaugurated recently. She's going to tell us about it. Joining us now is Dr. Katrina Bell Jordan, president of Northeastern Illinois University. You came all the way from next door.
All the way from next door.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you've been at Northeastern since 1997, became interim president last year, but you were inaugurated a couple of weeks ago.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You obviously know the university very well, and you've already, got a lot of experience in your role as interim, of course. What do you see as the university's strengths to build on?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Northeastern has a 157-year history and tradition in serving Chicago in creating spaces and places for folks who otherwise wouldn't have access to higher education. We started as a teacher's college and expanded over the years to include any number of programs. One of our strengths is recognizing that education is the pathway for many communities and offering that through teacher education programs, through practitioner programs. We are also a strong option for our new transfer students looking to complete their degrees. We have long had a history of being that kind of destination location for our neighboring two-year partner schools. We are also very proud to serve students that might not otherwise have an opportunity to go to college, and we have the opportunity and the privilege to teach and train them up so that they can be on a level playing field with their competitors from around the city and the state. We have extraordinary faculty, world-class faculty, and a real commitment to service and teaching and student success. So I think we have lots of strengths to move us forward.
All that said, what would you say are some of the challenges going forward? What do you have to work on?
Certainly. Well, at the global level, if you will, any of our state universities are experiencing changes in enrollment, declines, fluctuations. We are also currently in a state where attention to higher education and funding for higher education has returned as a priority. We have a long way to go to get to the kind of adequate funding that we need to deliver our programs, to have the kind of teaching and learning spaces that our students need. So it's always resources and, of course, responding to changing demographics. Students' needs have changed substantially since the pandemic, and trying to meet students where they are and still give them the tools that they need to be successful.
University, as we mentioned, it's been through a little bit of turmoil in recent years. A faculty vote of no confidence in the board and your predecessor, Gloria Gibson, a near faculty strike last year, and also struggling with enrollment declines as well as low graduation and retention rates. How are you working to steady the ship?
Certainly. Well, the transitional year for the interim president, which I was privileged to take on, was really the beginning of that transition, trying to regather the university's energies, its positive energies around charting a path forward. And that means getting folks together to engage folks that maybe had not been engaged, to tapping into the strengths and the resources and the community that we have. It is also having strong, decisive leadership where we can make quick decisions when we need to. I think also we're engaging in a process of strategic planning. We're launching this year. That will be formative as we chart our path forward. And I think we are seeing some returns. We had a 4% increase in fall enrollment for the first time in several years. Mm-hmm. It's just a step, but it does show that the strong effort around marketing and communication, supporting our programs and student success and retention, that we're moving in the right direction.
You're also a Hispanic-serving institution and a minority-serving institution. What do you think that means, and how do those designations, you know, what does it mean about how NAIU supports its students?
Sure. Well, we are a proud minority-serving institution and the oldest Hispanic-serving institution in our region. We also just qualified for Anapezi status, which is very exciting as well.
You're going to have to tell the non-higher ed academics what that means.
Yeah, Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander, that large, wonderful community. We have reached the threshold of having a percentage of students that help us qualify for grants and all kinds of things because we're serving that population of students. But taken together as a minority-serving institution, specifically as a Hispanic-serving institution, you know, what that means is a mission to serve. We have a longstanding relationship with these communities, rooted in both our multiple campuses. We have a beautiful Bronzeville historic campus in our south side. We have an Avondale neighborhood campus for our El Centro campus. And these are also extensions of our status and commitment to being an HSI and an MSI. It also means that our students are going to be in classes and programs that recognize the important diversity, the textures of difference and diversity that make their learning experience unique. We are also going to be graduating students that have been in classes that look more like the world that they're going to lead and work in a global environment where our classroom looks very much like the boardrooms and the students that they're going to be teaching when they go out into the world. And so I think we are teaching and training students that are going to be very successful on that front.
Universities have struggled over the last year with balancing students' right to free speech with speech that can be deemed hateful. Some university presidents have even lost their jobs over this issue. How do you plan to manage that issue?
Well, I think it's very important to think about two things. First of all, universities have always been contested spaces, beautifully so in many ways. We and universities and spaces of higher education have tried to cultivate spaces where differing opinions and viewpoints can safely and productively be engaged. We also are having to engage as universities in really what our role is in terms of speaking out and about things that happen at a national level and a global level. You know, what is our primary focus? Is it to teach, train, and help students learn, or is it to be a voice for certain positions? And so I think we are, like many institutions, in ongoing work with how we situate ourselves in response to challenges in the world.
All right. How would you describe your vision for NAIU?
Well, I would say it's big and bold. I've been at the university for 27 years, and I have seen what an NAIU education can mean in the lives of our students. And I think one of the most important aspects of the vision is visibility, so that our region recognizes not just that we are an HSI or an MSI, but that we are contributing to the local and regional workforce. We are helping to diversify our workforce with the students that come through Northeastern. I also know that we are going to have an opportunity to develop stronger partnerships with our two-year institutions to continue to grow that. We're growing programs like a nursing program, cybersecurity, and those things that I think are going to be impactful for our community.
Lots of work ahead for the newly inaugurated president of NEIU, Dr. Katrina Bell Jordan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to check out our WTTW News Voter Guide. It is a one-stop shop for everything you need to know before voting. You'll find candidate profiles and questionnaires, as well as key dates to know and how to find out if you're registered to vote. That is all at WTTW.com/voterguide. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. 7 Acero charter schools to close at the end of the school year. Parents, weigh in. And HIV cases are climbing among gay Latino men. Local health professionals on the reasons why and what can be done to combat it. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.